Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes a foodie? While Americans have always loved to eat, our sense of what is good to eat has evolved a great deal over the past couple of decades. And in trying to phase out heavily processed foods from our diets, many of us are discovering the exquisite pleasures of fresh, well-prepared foods, both locally produced and inspired by cuisines from around the world. For those just embarking on the process, blogger, writer, and photographer Pim Teshamwan-Vivit has created a sort of culinary roadmap. It's called the Foodie Handbook, the almost definitive guide to gastronomy. Pim, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
You write here that we should cook our own story. What does that mean?
That just means, really, we all, I think, you know, even if we have a complicated relationship with food now, at one point in our life, we all have this sort of love and just pure joy when we think about food. So if you want to kind of rethink your relationship with it, then my suggestion is to get back to the things that you love, the food that your mother cooked when you were growing up, your grandmother, or, you know, the food that you just, you know, remember relishing in your childhood. Get back to that, and that's going to really bring us back to rediscover our love of food.
Yeah, I love this idea because no matter what we make day to day, you say it's an important thing that we should all learn how to cook our parents' specialty dish, whatever that might have been.
Yeah, it's about, I mean, cooking is about family. Cooking is also about, you know, relinquishing all of that memories too. So really just, you know, no matter how good or how bad a cook you think your parents were or your, you know, your grandparents, there's always, I bet you, always something that they made that you just love. And learning how to cook that and, you know, preserving that knowledge for, you know, future generations, for your own kids or your nieces and nephews, that's just something great.
My grandmother made these things called pickled eggs, which are made with beets, which I know you don't like, and onions. And everybody else who's married into the family looks at them like they're never going to touch them. But for my sisters and me, they're this extraordinary comfort food.
Absolutely. And if you have children, if your sister has children, then, you know, they should learn to love it too.
What does the word foodie mean to you?
It means people who just love food. A foodie is somebody who loves food and has an opinion about it and really, you know, just willing to share. And in a way, we all are. You know, we all have, you know, something like, you know, going back to, you know, your grandmother's pickled eggs or, you know, someone else's grandmother's bolognese sauce or my grandmother's curry. There's always something that, you know, we just love and we have an opinion about.
Do all real foodies worth their salt need to know how to cook as well as eat?
Knowing how to cook is probably a good thing, yes. You know, knowing how to cook doesn't mean you have to cook, you know, like a fancy chef. You just need to learn how to put together a meal that you love and that your family love. I think that helps.
And you draw a distinction between cooking and recipe following. Can you explain that?
Yes. My friend Daniel Patterson, who's a really wonderful chef in San Francisco, once said that, you know, he thinks that cooking by following the recipe blindly is sort of like, you know, driving with a GPS on, which is so true. If you think about it, if all you think about is just, you know, go up to this corner, make a left turn, make a right turn, go two more miles, and you just sort of follow that. And if you turn the GPS off, you can't find your way back. And it's kind of the same way in cooking, by just blindly following the recipe or really just meticulously measuring everything, because then you kind of miss the tasting along the way, missed, you know, looking at how the meat is responding to the heat, how your vegetables doing, whether or not it has enough salt. And so I think we should be a little bit more mindful when we cook. It doesn't mean that you just completely, you know, throw the recipes away and never look at it, because, you know, even the best jazz musician don't compose a new music or a new song every time they play. So follow the recipe, but sort of use it as a guide, because no recipe could really just, you know, be so particular enough that everything in your kitchen will, you know, react the same way. Medium heat on your stove and on my stove may not be the same. Depends on, you know, what the what your, you know, how what your altitude is, how long you bake a cake might not be the same. So really, it's just about paying a little bit more attention than just following recipes step by step.
The very first concept that you discuss in this book is tasting like a foodie. What does that entail? We've all been tasting our whole lives. So what changes when you take a sort of foodie approach to this?
Well, I think what we do these days in our kind of busy life is we don't really pay attention. You know, I'm sure we all remember the last time we just mindlessly grab a giant bag of potato chips and, you know, sit in front of the TV, and before you know it, the whole bag is gone. And you probably don't even remember what the flavor was of that potato chips. So I think if we just kind of sit down and take a little bit of time and taste food and really savor it, savor the flavor, you'll probably have a better time. The food will taste better. And you'll eat less as well, which should be healthier for you.
Go ahead.
And I think everyone can taste the difference. If you hand someone a perfectly ripe peach that you just bought from the farmer's market or that you just picked from, you know, your backyard or your friend's backyard, and compare that to this rock-hard peach that you get in maybe February, flown in from goodness nowhere at a regular supermarket, you compare those two flavors, anyone could taste the difference.
Ingredients are obviously key here, and you suggest that we buy the best we can afford. In what categories of food does the extra money tend to make the most difference?
Probably everything, but I would say produce, the vegetables and fruit that you buy. There's such a difference in if you buy fruits that are grown locally and that are in season at the time. Compare that to, you know, again, strawberry you'd get in January that are flown in from Mexico or from South America somewhere. I think that's really where the flavors come through the most, is in your produce. So spend a little bit of money, you know, pay attention. And it's buying the best produce also doesn't always mean that you have to spend that much money. If you buy seasonally and if you buy, you know, from farmers market or from even just farm stands in your neighborhood, or, you know, if you're on a road trip and you happen upon a farm stand, those stuff won't be that expensive because it'll be grown right there. You won't have to pay for shipping from, you know, again, who knows where.
Yeah, the other cool idea you have when it comes, we have some great farmers markets in this part of the country, but it's also about building relationships with the people you see there so that you can ask them, are these peaches really worth it or should I go for the cantaloupe?
Oh, absolutely, because people who sell the food and grow the food have really, I mean, they have a passion that they can share with you. And that's true, of course, at farmers market, where those farmers, you know, spend the time in growing all that produce themselves. But it's also very often, you know, true at your local supermarkets. I have, you know, at my Whole Foods near my house here. Dave, the guy at the produce stand, is my best friend. I walk in and go, oh, here, try. He would, you know, hand me a grape or something and go, oh, you have to try this. This is so good right now. So those are the people that you really want to, you know, be friends with and ask questions. And everyone, in my experience, they're all very happy to share and very happy to be helpful.
Another thing that you recommend is finding a cheese dealer that you really can connect with.
Yes, absolutely. That was my luck when I first moved to San Francisco. I live next to, or not next to, but very near this little cheese shop called Cowgirl Creamery. And it was just so amazing. I could, you know, I walk in all the time and I would pick this cheese and that cheese. And I learned so much from the woman who used to run it, who owns it still, called Peggy. And she just taught me so much about cheese. And it's amazing when you cultivate that kind of relationship with the people who are passionate and who really know about the food, how much you can learn from them.
My guest is Pim Techumwam-Vivit. She is a blogger, an author, and a photographer. Her new book is called The Foodie Handbook, The Almost Definitive Guide to Gastronomy. I wanted to mention, again, the fact that you're a photographer because you've taken every photograph in the book. Is that correct?
Not every, actually. We have a professional photographer who helped me. She took a bunch of photographs for the book, and the ones with me in it, for example, I didn't take.
Right. But I'm wondering, too, there's also a visual aspect to being a foodie and to just appreciating what things look like.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, we all eat with our eyes. So approaching, you know, when we look at something new and something that, you know, we're kind of trying to decide whether we want to eat it or not, the first thing that we do is we look at it. We kind of taste first with our eyes. So the visual aspect is very, very important.
So much of our eating these days is done in restaurants. You have some really good ideas for truly enjoying those meals. And it starts with being willing just to try new things when you step into the restaurant.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you go to a restaurant and, you know, the people who work there, the chef, put together this menu that he or she's probably very passionate about. And it's kind of worth it to try new things once in a while. Just to kind of expand your horizon a bit. When I was little, I spent a lot of time with my grandfather, who was a foodie before the term was invented. And he had a deal with me when we go to restaurants or when we go to a new place. He's like, you know what? Order anything you want. Order whatever you want to try. And if you didn't like it, you wouldn't have to eat it. If I didn't like it, I didn't have to eat it. And I think that was kind of a great thing to do with your with kids sometimes is just, you know what, go ahead, try something. Because if you didn't like it, you don't have to kind of try to, you know, sit in front of this giant plate of tripe or something and try to put it away. Because then it really expanded my horizon. It was, you know, it became a situation where, you know what, I'll try everything at least once.
And I like the idea, too, of going into a restaurant, willing to try new things, and then you recommend that we look on the menu for what is made with seasonal ingredients.
Absolutely. Again, it's getting back to, you know, cooking with what is fresh and eating things that are fresh and, you know, preferably even locally grown, because that's what's good. That's what's good at the time and the quality. It's like right now, squash and pumpkins coming up everywhere, so pumpkin soup and squash soup is going to be really great. If I go to a restaurant and I see that on the menu, that'd be what I eat. And another thing about eating, you know, seasonally and locally also is I think a lot of great restaurants have this thing that, you know, some people refer to it as the sense of place. It's like this kind of great restaurant that reflects the culture of food that surrounds it. So, you know, when you go to New Orleans, you eat the beignets and, you know, you eat the jambalaya, and it's the food that sort of feels like the surroundings, and it's really good. Or, you know, when we're in Texas, barbecue, of course. I used to work for a company that has an office in Richardson, and that would be one of the first things I hit is, come on, let's go eat barbecue, because out here in San Francisco, there's not a lot of that.
And I also like the idea that when you go to a new place, you'll ask for a recommendation, but still sort of get what you want, not be talked into something that you didn't want.
Right, because I think there's this aspect of sort of people trying to really just, you know, they think that to be a foodie means that you have to, you know, love everything and you have to love every odd-looking things on the menu. And I mean, in a way, I think trying everything is a great thing, but if you didn't like it and if something really does not appeal to you, it's kind of, you know, it's not going to be fun eating it. You might as well just move on and try something else.
Pim Techumwam-Vivit is my guest. Her new book is called The Foodie Handbook, The Almost Definitive Guide to Gastronomy. We'll return in just a moment. You can get on the line now to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Blogger and writer Pim Teshamwan-Vivit is my guest. Her new book is called The Foodie Handbook, The Almost Definitive Guide to Gastronomy. If you'd like to join us, our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So let's talk for a minute about eating when you travel. First of all, you are cautious but otherwise fearless. You're not that worried that you'll get sick eating, say, street food in a foreign country.
Well, a little bit. I think I kind of have a little bit of a healthy skepticism when it comes to a lot of the food on the street when I travel. But it's, you know, it's there's some simple rules that I follow that I wrote about on the book, that in the book that that has helped me over the years. And I think one of the things that is really important is eat the food that's cooked in front of you. Eat the food that's really hot. And you can get a lot of these in Asia. I mean, a lot of street food is basically either grilled or like fried or something right in front of you. And when food is hot, it's usually probably safer. And by hot, I mean, you know, it should burn your fingers as you're holding it. It should drill a hole in your tongue as you're eating, in your tongue as you're eating it. So it's, I'd like to say, well, think of just sort of warm food that had been cooked a while ago and was just sort of lolling and just sitting around waiting for someone to buy. That's sort of like, you know, warm environment is like, you know, think of it as germ spa. You do not want to deal with germs that had just come from a day at germ spa.
And the other thing you say is follow the locals. They know what's good.
Absolutely. It's, you know, when you go to a market and there are two stalls selling grilled chicken, say, and one of them has this line that wrap around the corner and the other one is just sort of kind of not very busy, I'd suggest getting, you know, walking to the end of the line and wait in the line for that grilled chicken, because the locals usually know what's good. You're not likely to, you know, discover something completely new that locals don't know about.
And you carry, when you travel, your own utensils.
I usually have some backups, yes, mm-hmm. because a lot of times when you travel, it may not be the food that'll get you sick. It's these sort of not particularly clean utensils, like, you know, bamboo chopsticks that have this sort of, like, scary brown and black bits in the, in the wood grain. It's that kind of stuff that I look at it and I go, oh, I don't really want to use that to shovel food into my mouth. So I carry my own disposable utensils with me when I travel. And, you know, you just kind of use your judgment. Look around, see what, you know, what other people are eating, see what you feel about the cleanliness of the stall. And sometimes, you know, I break out my own chopsticks or spoon, and it makes me feel better.
So you essentially just, you know when you need it.
Yeah, you know when you, yeah. Food is kind of, you know, in a way, bad food tells you it's bad. It doesn't smell very good, doesn't look very good. It's kind of, you know, use your judgment. It works most of the time.
Pim Teshamwan-Vivit is my guest. We're talking about her new book, The Foodie Handbook. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go first to Lois in North Dallas. Hello, Lois. Hi, Lois.
Hi, Lois.
Hi. Are you
Hello.
With us?
Yes, I am here.
Great.
I just want to go back to Cowgirl Creamery, and I have a hard time believing you mentioned it because two things you had just said made them come to my mind. I discovered them. I live here, but I frequently travel to the Bay Area on business. Mm-hmm. And on one trip, we were going to a picnic that night. I needed to take something. I went to the local Whole Foods market, found the cheese. They packed it nicely. I brought it back, took it to the picnic. We loved it. And since then, we've found it at both our local Whole Foods and Central Market. And it's funny, when we walk into the cheese department, they'll come and get me, oh, we've got Cowgirl Creamery today.
So it's a great discovery. Thanks for your call, Lois.
That's great. Yes, they don't, Cowgirl Creamery doesn't just sell cheese. They actually make their own as well. And Peggy Smith, one of the owners, I call her my cheese godmother, my cheesy godmother. She's taught me so much about food. And one of the things that's great, when you go to friendly stores like that, you know, a lot of times, like when I'm at Cowgirl Creamery and I see something new, a new cheese, and I ask them what it tastes like, they're like, well, here, taste it. You know, not only that, they will tell you and sort of explain to you what they think of it, they'll just, you know, hand you a piece. And you get to try it yourself, and you can, you know, see if you like it before you buy.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Julie in Dallas. Hey, Julie.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I don't really have a question. I have more of a comment and a thank you for suggesting that we share our recipes down through the generations. One of my favorite things that I've ever gotten from any of my family members was my great-grandmother's recipe for banana bread. And I can remember being a little girl, my mother taught it to me, and her mother taught it to her, and when I was little, I remember asking, why does it say sift all the ingredients three times? And my mom having to explain that there used to be bugs and things like that in the flour. So for me and my family, some of the most precious things that I've ever gotten are my great-grandmother's recipes and my grandmother's handwritten recipe cards.
Oh, what a great story. Thank you so much for sharing that.
That's great.
And I just want to say thanks for suggesting that.
Oh, you're welcome. You should start a blog and and share those. I would love to try your great-grandmother's banana bread.
How did you get started on the blog, Pim? My understanding is that at first you just wanted to keep in touch with your friends around the world.
Yes, I grew up in Bangkok, and I went to school in some other places, and I end up, you know, living in California. So I have friends all over the world, and when blogging was just getting started, I was working in technology, and I thought, oh, this would be something fun to try, you know, instead of writing an email with 30 names and a 2 a CC line to tell your friends what you're up to. I started writing it all on the blog. And then it just became, it started out with just these sort of mundane things about my life that I'm telling friends, that I was telling friends. And then I started writing about food. My friends would ask me about something I just made for them or, you know, some other food of mine that they love and ask for recipes. So I started putting recipes on the blog. And then I started writing about restaurants when I travel. And then it just became the food blog that that it is today.
So
entirely by accident.
And this is full-time for you now, right?
Yes, it is.
Can you talk for a minute about this? You write that a true foodie never buys bottled salad dressing. Why is it that it's funny? Because a lot of people sort of don't realize you can make salad dressing.
Yes, I think, well, you know, that was, I was kind of half-joking about that. It's not, didn't mean to sound that judgmental, but a salad dressing is really, really so simple to make with just a couple of ingredients. And if you're busy, you can make your own and then keep a jar of it or a bottle of it in your fridge, and it'll last, you know, a couple of weeks. It's going to taste so much better than what you could buy out of a jar.
And you, it's very interesting here, you experiment not only with just olive oil, but you use a lot of nut oils in your dressing.
Yeah, I think it's really a lot of fun to try different things. So my basic salad dressing is just a dab of mustard and then and salt and pepper and a little bit of vinegar and olive oil. That's pretty much it. And then, you know, just to kind of keep myself from getting bored, I switch the vinegar. Sometimes I use sherry vinegar. Sometimes I use red wine vinegar. Sometimes I put a little bit of honey in and sometimes I don't. And also even the oil, you could switch it by using, there's a lot of wonderful nut oil that are very healthy that you can get at you know, even just regular supermarkets now. Walnut oil is wonderful, pine nuts and, you know, sesame oil, or even grapeseed oil. They all have really fun, interesting flavor, and you can just switch them.
Are they too strong to use by themselves?
They can be. I think walnut oil, for example, can be really pretty strong. So it's probably maybe I would suggest starting with adding a little bit of it to olive oil, just to see if you like it first.
Mm-hmm. And you think that everybody needs to know how to roast a chicken. Will you talk about your favorite method?
Oh, my favorite method is the method I got from this very famous French chef called Joao Robuchon. And it's really very simple. And the trick is just, instead of putting the chicken onto a roasting pan and shoving it into the oven, you actually roast the chicken first on the side. Because you know how when we roast a chicken or when we eat roast chicken out, many times the breast is the part that dries out. And then sometimes the thighs are not fully cooked. And if you fully cook the thigh, the breast would be just kind of really not worth eating because it's all dried. So the trick in this method is you flip the chicken on the side and you roast it with one of the thighs up first. So it's, imagine this chicken and you just kind of like flip it on the side and have one thigh resting against the pan and the other thigh kind of pointing up. You roast it that like that for a little bit, and then you flip it over for the other thigh, and this gives a chance, you know, the thighs will hit the heat first, will get nice and brown and beautiful and crisp, and then just before you finish, you flip it with the breast side up, which is, you know, the way that normal recipes will call for when you roast a chicken. And then you just finish it by browning the top and get the skin nice and crisp. And then because in this method, the breast meat has been sort of protected from the heat, mm-hmm. and it's only fully exposed at the last minute, the last, you know, 15, 20 minutes or something. And so your whole chicken's cooked evenly, and the skin is crackly and golden and beautiful, and it's really the best.
Does this work for, say, Thanksgiving turkey as well?
A turkey's pretty big, yeah. So it's going to be pretty clunky trying to flip it around. it might not be a great idea.
Mm-hmm. What do you do for Thanksgiving? Do you do all the traditional dishes, or do you sort of mix it up a little bit?
I love traditional Thanksgiving dinners, actually, because to me, you only get it once a year. Mm-hmm. So I like it very traditional, and I don't cook Thanksgiving meal. My partner, David Kinch, and I go to his parents' house. And his mom cooks this wonderful Thanksgiving spread that's very traditional. They're from Pennsylvania, and I just love it.
Pim Techumwanvivit is my guest. Her new book is called The Foodie Handbook, The Almost Definitive Guide to Gastronomy. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So I have to confess, I cook, but except for that famous no-knead bread from the New York Times, I do not bake. You insist here, though, that baking is not only possible to do well, it can, in fact, be pretty easy.
It can be pretty easy, and it can be really a lot of fun, too. Baking is one of those things that people seem to be afraid of, and I think my suggestion is really just try it. Try it once. I mean, you have, you know, maybe okay if you think about baking a pie or baking a tart. The process of making a crust can kind of scare you. But if you try it once, and, you know, maybe you fail the first time, but do it another time, and you'll get it, really. It's really not that hard. And once you have that pie crust or tart crust under your belt, then you can make all kinds of pies, and this whole kind of world of dessert opens for you. You can make open-faced tarts with any kind of fruit that's in season at the moment. There's a really good crust recipe, and I would also think that it's really easy in my book. And I just blogged yesterday about how to make frangipane, which is this kind of almond cream made with almond and butter and sugar and a little bit of egg. And you could, and that's super easy to make. You basically, the making of it involved putting everything in your food processor and process it and turn it into this paste, this deliciously luscious paste. And you just make your pie crust, or you know what, if you're really that afraid, go and buy an all-butter pie crust from the supermarket. Put it on a baking sheet, make that frangipane I just said, and spread it on, and then cut up some fruits and, you know, line it up beautifully on the tart crust. Bake it in the oven. It will convert you from... It'll stop your fear of baking, I promise you.
Well, I confess I hadn't really thought until I was paging through your book about once you've got that tart crust down, there are literally unlimited numbers of things you can do with it, not just sweet things, but savory as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you can, and baking a tart and baking a pie is just something like super fun that you can experiment with. You know, there's a lot of fruit out right now, apples and pears, and I love to mix fresh apples and fresh pears with some dried fruit, like fresh apples and maybe dried raisins or pears and dried prunes, and you could really, it's just completely unlimited. This opens up this huge world of baking for you.
We should talk here a little bit about drinks, because that's also, you have Drink Like a Foodie in the book. You do not really believe in having a strong cocktail before you eat dinner.
You know, sometimes if you just want to go out with friends and just kind of have fun, having a cocktail is perfectly fine. But if you're going to a fancy restaurant, maybe some place that you've been saving up for, if you're going to, say, the French Laundry or Alinea in Chicago for the first time, you probably don't want to drink very strong cocktail to begin with because of a couple of reasons. You're likely going to be drinking a lot of wine with that dinner, so you might not want to get completely sauced before you begin. And also, harsh alcohol kind of kills your palate. Excuse me. It kills your palate. You can't really taste as much after you drink a lot of strong alcohol. So I suggest maybe saving it, you know, for the end of the meal.
Or have a strong drink at a restaurant that you know is not very good.
Yes, that's highly recommended as well.
And you like to Google ahead and find out exactly what you can find about a new place you're going to try.
Absolutely. I mean, with this, you know, world of information that's saturated by information that we live in, there are so many things that you could look up in front of, you know, ahead of time to learn a little bit about the restaurant you're going to, so that you know how to spend your money, what to eat, and kind of get a little bit of sense of what you're going to see.
Pim Techumwanvivit is my guest. Her new book is called The Foodie Handbook, The Almost Definitive Guide to Gastronomy. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Pim Techumwanvivit. Her new book is called The Foodie Handbook, The Almost Definitive Guide to Gastronomy. She also has a blog online called Shape Him. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Pim, you say that the old rules, the sort of standby rule of thumb that people have about red wine with red meat, white wine with white meat, ought to go out the window at this point.
Yeah, I think we can be a lot more experimental. We can have a lot more fun with that. It's one way to think about it is the meat itself, especially in the way we eat today, it's not, you know, a giant piece of meat and just a little bit of sauce and a piece or two of vegetables on the side. But the way we eat today with, you know, maybe a lot more vegetables with pasta or with other kind of carbohydrates with the meat and, you know, with cooked in all kinds of different sauce, we should kind of maybe rethink because it depends on what kind of sauce goes with that meat. If you're cooking a chicken and you're cooking a chicken with braise it in red wine and, you know, do this like kind of red wine and maybe mushroom sauce and something really earthy and beautiful, that's going to be a dish that might overwhelm white wine. So you probably want to serve it with red wine. So the trick is to look at what you what is that meat and that, you know, cooked in, and what else are you eating around it? And that, you know, that may not always mean that, you know, you're going to drink white wine with chicken.
And is it artichokes that no wine goes with, no matter what?
Artichoke is something difficult, yes. It's a little bit difficult to pair wine with. It makes wine, turns it sweet and kind of odd. So if you're having, you know, a main course of artichoke, it might not be the best idea to serve wine, but if it's a little bit of artichokes, it's probably not so bad.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Ed in Arlington. Hello, Ed.
Hi. I was wondering if Kim had much experience with Tex-Mex food, either cooking it herself or dining out. It's my impression, it's been a while since I've spent any time in California, but even with California's Spanish heritage, it's my impression that there's not a whole lot of Tex-Mex cooking, or what we call Tex-Mex in this area. There's not a whole lot of that in the Bay Area, so I was wondering if she had much to do with it in her travels.
Thanks for your call. What do you think about Tex-Mex, Pim?
Not much, actually. I'd love to know more about it. And you're right. There's not a lot of Tex-Mex cooking in the Bay Area. Or I think what they call Tex-Mex here is probably not something you want to be, you know, anyone in Texas want to be associated with at all. So I would love to learn more. Do you have any recommendation? Where should I go?
Let's see. Ed, do you have any favorite places she might want to check out?
Well, the... My information is a little bit dated, but the old standby in this area is Joe T. Garcia's in Fort Worth. It's an experience if you haven't been there before. It's pretty mainstream. In terms of the more exotic, cutting-edge places, people trying out, cooks trying out new things, I can't really guide you there. I'm sure there are other people in the area that could, though.
Yeah, thanks so much for your call.
Yeah.
Thanks. Christy, have any favorite?
There are a lot of good places around here. If I name something now, I'm going to name something where the chef has just changed or whatever. So I'm leave it alone. Joe T's is great, though. They've got, like, fajitas, and it's kind of a fun garden atmosphere as well. The food is delicious, but it's also really about the experience of being there, and you usually go with a crowd, which is really a lot of fun.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
Yeah. Let's see. We have an email here from MA who wants to know, what do you take to your partner's parents' traditional Thanksgiving dinner?
I don't usually do anything for that dinner at all. I just show up expecting Thanksgiving dinner in all its glory.
That's
nice. We always get it. But I often bring things that I make. I make jams and marmalade at home. So that's usually a good kind of, you know, hostess gift, not just for David's parents, but also for when I go to dinner at someone's house.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next on the phone to Tyler, where we'll speak with LaShawn. Hi, LaShawn.
Hi. You know, I was just wondering, I actually moved from the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, about 5 years ago here to Tyler, and my financial status has changed. I love food. I love different cheeses and different types of fruits. But I'm wondering, do you have any recommendations on still remaining a foodie in this economy?
I think cooking for yourself is something that you could save money on. I mean, you know, we were talking about roasting a chicken before. I think I would roast a chicken even when I was eating alone and cooking for myself, because I could eat, you know, a piece of it and then keep the rest for the next day. I could, you know, tear out some meat and make a sandwich, or sometimes tear out some meat and stir fry it with some rice. You could stretch what you cook in many different ways. And if you sort of think a little bit and be a little bit creative about how you use your leftovers, I think that that's a way to save money, definitely.
We have an email from Rollins who wants to know if you would share with us the worst meal or dish you either made or were served.
Wow.
Any spectacular failures in your past?
Oh, all kinds of things. I can't even begin to say. I think the first time I made a pie crust, we were kind of talking about pie crust before. The first time I made a pie crust, it was a pretty interesting failure. It looks beautiful on the board, on the pastry board, and I couldn't get the entire thing to move. It just turned into this kind of patchwork pie crust that I have to you know, take out in a little bit at a time and reassemble in my pie plate. That was a lot of fun.
So I have to ask you this. You're a food writer and your partner is a chef. Do you both argue about food? Do you talk about food all the time? Or do you think to yourselves, well, this is kind of shop talk and we got to do something else?
No, we talk about food all the time. We talk about food all the time. When we travel, we think first about where to eat. We have pretty limited life. Yes, and we cook on his days off. We cook at home, and a lot of times I cook just to kind of give David a little bit of time off, but he also loves to cook, so there are things that, you know, he insists on doing it himself at home, too.
You have some funny things in here about how to tell that a restaurant maybe is not worth the money you might spend there, one of which is when it has truffles available. Will you talk about that?
Well, right now, truffles is coming into season, so if you can afford it, it's probably something fun that you want to try. It's really delicious. It adds an interesting dimension to pretty much anything it touches. But I was talking about restaurants that have truffles on the menu year-round, because truffles are one of those things that when they're at their best, they're amazing, and when they're mediocre, they're really, really gross. You know, think like old gym socks that, you know, kind of left over in the trunk of your car and baked in the Texas sun for a few days. They're really bad. But there are, I mean, really sort of fancy restaurants that serve really expensive food that has, you know, everything with truffles or a lot of things with truffles, even at the height of summer. And that's the kind of place you probably might not want to go to, because they're going to be really expensive and the quality is not going to be that great.
Do you think our relationship to sort of fancy restaurants has changed in terms of this generation of people, that we don't necessarily go and expect to wear a cocktail dress and have a white tablecloth, even if the food is supposed to be really, really good?
Yeah, and I think that's that's probably one of the things that, you know, we Americans have contributed to the food world. I think we look at food and we, you know, even when you take food seriously, you don't really want to take the surroundings that seriously. So there are a lot of, you know, really casual places that serves really good food, that it's, you know, it's not about going there and be waited hand and foot by uniformed waiters with, you know, white tablecloth and everything comes on a silver tray with a silver dome on top of it. Although, you know, that once in a while is fun as well. You know, if you haven't tried it, when you next time you find yourself in Europe, you might want to, you know, go to like a 3 Michelin star restaurant just to have an experience.
You write here about, you know, the fact that so many foodies also want to eat ethically. And I wonder if you can talk about some of the things that you consider when you're deciding what you will cook or what you will eat.
Well, I think, you know, as foodies, we think also not just about what we're eating today, but, you know, what's going to be around, you know, for the next generation or even just for us when we get older. So it's definitely, you know, good to think a little bit about how to eat sustainably. You know, when you buy canned tuna, think about making sure that the canned tuna is, you know, dolphin safe. And or when you buy fish, make sure that it's sustainably caught or farmed. If you don't want to kind of think of it as this altruistic thing, you could think of it as, you know, being greedy and making sure that we keep those resources for ourselves when, you know, in a few decades from now. And one of the things that really changed my way of thinking about this is this shark fin. When I grew up in Bangkok, and shark fin soup in Asia is this thing that is, you know, it's like the black truffles of Asia. It's, people think of it as this exotic, expensive, amazing ingredients that, you know, is also kind of a cure-all. It's good for your health. It's good for your joints. And all of these. And when you go to fancy Chinese restaurants, they always serve shark fin soup. And they also happen to taste really good. Really, I think about it and I'm still, my mouth waters a little bit. So I grew up eating that all the time, and I remember about 10 years ago, I watched a documentary, I think it was Discovery Channel, about sharks. And there was a story about harvesting sharks in Asia, because in Asia, we don't eat shark meat. It's not really something that's prized. So when you catch a shark, the only parts of a shark that's valuable are the fins. So it's kind of scary. I should warn you. The fishermen would catch a shark and then cut off all the fins and then throw back the body into the water as bait for other sharks. And it was this horrific, horrific scene that just imprinted in my head. And that was when I said, I'm going to stop eating shark fin because I just cannot condone that kind of behavior. It's just, and it's a personal choice. I mean, I'm sure, you know, tons of people are still eating shark fins around the world. But for me, it's just something that I just can't do it anymore. And it's not easy. I was just in Bangkok recently and, you know, walked by a couple of places that sold shark fin soup and you could smell it in the air. And I was like, oh, nope, but I'm just not going to.
I guess at that point you couldn't fully enjoy it anyway. You couldn't let go like you described at the beginning of the program.
That's probably true, yeah. And you know, I'm not saying that I only eat ethically grown and raised food and I don't eat anything that's, you know, unethical at all in my eating life. I'm not that good, nowhere near that. But, you know, there are certain things that if all of us give up one or two things, then you know, it's going to be better for the world in general.
The other thing you say, speaking of giving up one or two things, everybody should be allowed to have one or two or three things that they just don't like to eat and don't have to eat.
Yes, absolutely. Speaking from, you know, from a personal point of view, I don't eat beets and no one can make me a beet dish that I could eat. And I'm just not going to. And it's you know, one of these things that are maybe just, you know, it's a difference in scale. If you have a few things that you don't eat, that you just don't like, that, you know, nothing anyone could do to those ingredients would make you like them, then you probably don't want to bother. It's like, why bother? Life is short. Eat what you like. But at the same time, if you're one of these people that have sort of the list of your aversions, and I'm not talking about, you know, allergies, but I'm talking about just aversions. If you don't like, if your list of ingredients that you don't like goes, you know, 2-3 pages long, that might be, you know, you might want to reconsider at least some of that.
The last thing I want to ask you in the last 15 seconds, do you have a favorite meal of the day?
Favorite meal of the day? I think dinner cooked at home.
Cozy, yeah. And exactly what you want.
Yes.
The new book by blogger and writer Pim Tetchamwanvivit is called The Foodie Handbook, The Almost Definitive Guide to Gastronomy. Pim, it's been a real pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, Chris. It's been great. Thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.